Thanks for having me. This is also, I'm sorry, just before coffee break, and I'm not even having any slides. You have, just have to listen to me. Yeah. True anthropology. Right. Should I?
Sorry.
No. What?
Maybe we just go minimize. So you can just switch it off.
Right. All right. Cash is king no more. What does the decreasing circulation and usage of cash in contemporary Sweden mean for our, or Swedes, perception of money? Money, said a 30-something friend, I never carry money in my wallet. I always pay with card. Cash as payment has steadily been replaced by bank transfers, checks that came and went, credit cards and online payments. Every kid seems to have a cash card, and the few actual cash purchases made decrease in value. Any cup of coffee or other purchase my friend pays for is with a credit card. Money's just irritating to handle, he says. Second impression from everyday Swedish life, an entry on Facebook from a former colleague and mother of three. It is the only first-time parents who have the time asking for 40 krona contribution for a Christmas flower. For to the kid's teacher. I mean, who carries cash anymore? I want an app. So, how does our relationship to money change when cash increasingly disappears? Or does it? The issue of cashless society is raised in many places, and the answers are often sought in economic reasoning. It is more efficient and cheaper. As an anthropologist, though, it is easy to propose that there's more to this answer. This paper addresses the contemporary meaning of money amongst a group of people living in Sweden when everyday payments are increasingly electronic. Moving away from the economist's view of money as a commodity subject to market laws, Keith Hart asserted that money as something intangible is an expression of three different theories of human agency. Firstly, money can be seen as the result of government policy and is thus a vertical relationship between the issuer, the state, and the people using the money. The state governs us and takes care of us, just like the depiction of head and tails on a coin. Secondly, that money represents the accumulated traditions of those who use them. Money can thus be given meaning in various ways, as Viviana Selaiser, for example, has shown and many of you have referred to. But there are also contexts when using money is seen as immoral, inappropriate, and plain wrong. This brings us to the third view, when money is seen as an expression of faith and trust between people. An example of how we manage debt and credit relations. In this sense, it is a reflection of society's moral values. I will use Keith Hart's insight to speculate a bit about the slow disappearance of cash in Sweden. It is a kind of armchair anthropology based on some statistics on the use of different means of payment in Sweden, of insights from discussions amongst three consecutive master student classes that I led, and my reading of what a few wise thinkers say and write about money and digits. Sweden is not the foremost example, as it trails other Scandinavian countries where debit cards have replaced cash in retail to a larger extent. But as my home country, I know it well. I pose more questions than answers here, so it is a modest reflection of what this change can mean for Swedes in our everyday life. And my focus is not the money nutters, i.e. those with the stated goal to use only cash, to fight poverty, to create alternative exchange strategies and who avoid the state for various reasons, as for example Bill Maurer has written about, but rather money cutters, if you excuse my flawed travesty. So, any proposals of what to do with this material I have and further pursue it is much appreciated. So, that clinking clanking sound can make the world go around, they sang in cabaret. We still use money, and it, the idea of money, probably more than ever makes the world revolve. But what to make out of the situation when payments do not change hands anymore? The small change of coins or the counting of bills by hand disappears, and one never look into a more or less full wallet, but just one with colourful plastic cards. Or when payments only appear as digits on our cell phones. Does the reduction of cash use make money just appear as numbers, as Caitlin Zaloom suggested in her depiction of the digitalization of the Chicago Board of Exchange, and how it affects the future traders? Will money increasingly be a balance represented by some numbers that we check digitally now and then? Or perhaps never, unless the card payment is denied, and instead replaces the old checkbook entries? Or maybe we just keep the materiality of bundles of cash and coins when we buy a product or service, making life a bit simpler. Or perhaps it does not mean a thing. Avoiding cash, we do not see the money, and Hart's first point on money as the relation between citizen and state disappear. Paying for purchases electronically, Swedes will not be reminded of author Selma Lagerlöf and King Gustav Vasa 500 years ago. Without cash, do we lose the connection to both history and government, or actually to the central bank that issues coins and bills and warrants their value? But before moving on to the perception of contemporary money, what is happening to cash usage in Sweden? The amount of cash in circulation in Sweden has decreased by 10% between 2008 and 2012. The issuer of Swedish money, the Riksbank, i.e. the Swedish central bank, changed its policy or its stance in 2007 regarding cash, and now defines its contemporary role to supply and demand and to destroy banknotes and coins that can no longer be used. It is the commercial banks who demand the amount of banknotes and coins they consider necessary to meet the needs of the Swedish people. The Riksbank does not take a stand on more or less cash in society, but just notes the development and publicly voices the view that society would never be completely cashless. It might be a sign of the diminishing cash times that although the bank is responsible for Sweden's monetary policy, it does not have any impact anymore how much physical money circulates in society. Compare this with the view of those who actually handle cash, employees in banking and finance. Their union, the Finance Association, sponsors the website Cashfree, or Kontantfritt in Swedish. The central question posed is, quote, who needs cash, end quote, reflecting an aim to create a safer working environment for the union's employees. The website continues, and I quote, a big part of all cash exists in the criminal sector. Pushers, robbers, and black workers needs cash. For us, there are better alternatives. We want a society without cash to avoid robberies of banks, shops, and restaurants. Bank branches seem soon to be a thing of the past, but perhaps not due to the above website. If you find a branch office and you want to deposit cash, you're today met with suspicion. For amounts above a certain level, most banks even require some sort of certificate for the origin of the money. You might otherwise be under the assumption to perform cash laundry of recompense originating in moonlighting or some other crime. According to the Swedish Tax Agency, financial exchange transmitters like Western Union make good business neither asking for origin of the stash deposited nor being checked by the financial regulator. And that's where the larger amount of money apparently also are whitewashed. While a quintessential governmental monetary institution, the Riksbank, takes its hand away from governing Swedes' usage of cash, the vertical relation between a citizen and state might still be strengthened. Cash is anonymous, whereas a payment with a card, by bank transfer, or with mobile payments leaves a trail of our physical operations and procurement preferences. It shows what we have bought, where, and when. This replaces the old checkbook with the difference that I, the purchaser, can avoid the tedious noting of dates, amounts, and purchase something, also between people. And this view requires us to accept that society rests on nothing more solid. No, sorry. Ooh. I'm sorry about this. Yes. Back to the replacing of the old checkbook. Purchase specification. Someone else keeps track of each movement, and this information is stored. The digital trace of any financial transaction is easy to find not only for the purchaser and seller, but also for fraudsters through electronic illegal intrusion and for governing or surveillance bodies like police and anti-terrorist institutions who have easy access under the so-called right conditions. But the website of the financial workers reminds us that this trade can also be seen in a positive light. If you lose or are robbed on a few hundreds, they are gone. With a card fraud, you almost always have the money back in your account a few days later. You can always block a card, whereas it is difficult to prove the cash belongs to you. The disappearance of material money in Swedish society caused for a lively discussion amongst the master students. Yet no one of them reflected over the possibility of not having enough money. Sweden is a fairly affluent society, even for the relatively poor students. They seem sure of having enough to pay for the everyday groceries. They do not need to look in their wallets. If money comes as cash or in digits, has nothing to do with wealth, it seems. It is rather that the materiality of money involves longer handling time, is more cumbersome to deal with, and if it comes in larger stashes, raises suspicious looks. Like Laura, a British student, said, quote, "People also use the cards that I almost feel I get a curious look if I pay with cash anyway." If cash handling is communicated as the outcome of informal criminal practice or give us suspicious looks, paying with cash also renounces the state even more. Where does that leave us? So back to Keith Hart in his book The Memory Bank. He wrote, "In an age of electronic money, other possibilities present themselves. For money is principally a way of keeping track of what people do with each other. It is above all information, a measure of transactions. Money need not be left to the death struggle of the disembodied twins, the states and the markets. In short, money might become more meaningful than it has ever been of late." End quote. So money means something also between people, and this we view requires us to accept that society rests on nothing more solid than the transient exchanges we participate in. However, following Viviana Zelizer's view of money as the accumulated traditions of those who use them, we will increasingly think of money as digital numbers only. But money as a trail of numbers would, according to Thomas Crump, economize relations even more. Quoting him, "Once again, numbers succeed because they need no culture-specific support, and no culture has an inbuilt defense against numeracy. Numeracy is a sort of Trojan horse, for once it is admitted, the institution it supports tend to become dominant in every domain, whether it be the local economy, leisure and play, religion, or whatever." End quote. So on one hand, paying and transferring money electronically makes the state as a guarantee of money's value less visible. On the other hand, can the digits the electronic payments leave be seen, as Crump suggested, like a Trojan horse? But there is not only one horse, there are several potential intruders here. With the convenience of electronic payment, all our payments, to whom, when, and what are possible to trace, and also thus our movement through society. Hart's point of money as depicting the vertical relationship between the issuer and the people using the money, this relationship ciphers out. Instead, a one-way relation of being able to trace the everyday movements of a citizen through her his purchases is possible. And most people do not seem to reflect on this version of cashlessness. Instead, the supposed materiality of coins and notes is going, and left is the idea of money expressed by keeping its name. My friend said he doesn't carry money anymore. It seemed like a slip of tongue, as he meant the everyday synonym cash, as he carries money as much as ever, just in another form. The origin of its name, moneta, is perhaps more relevant than ever, as the meaning is inscribed in the root of its name, derived from Latin, quote, to remind, to tell, a bearer of collective memory, what we've done together, so to say. For the Romans, it was a memento of the past and a sign of the future. Traditions are changing also for the handling of money, and cash is perhaps not king anymore, if it ever was, but will probably play a role for the foresighted future, for money nutters, cutters, and all the rest of us. So it is up to us, the users, to make our transactions and exchanges meaningful in society, regardless of how we pay for our necessities in life. My very pragmatic friends who renounces cash seems to do this. He doesn't care. As long as there is a terminal that accepts his credit card, he swipes it through the machine, punches his 4-digit code, picks up his cup of coffee, and moves on with his busy life.
Mentioned that I really enjoyed this paper, and I'll just say it again, really enjoyed this paper. You've mentioned that the people you were speaking with and who you've been talking about are fairly affluent. So I would say, what about the flip side of money, the heads and the tails, to borrow Keith Hart's metaphor? Mm. What about the poorest people in society? Where are their relations to cash? Because you've also talked about the moral entanglement of cash, as it's bandits and Russian oligarchs who have cash. Mm-hmm. Where are the homeless beggars, where are the people who call upon our cash in this picture?
Mm. Very good question. I mean, what we have seen the last 2 years in Sweden is a lot of people begging, coming from southern Eastern Europe, most probably. And obviously, that's cash. I have no idea to answer you correctly. Mm. When I wrote this paper, which was years ago, and I thought it out, this was an opportunity to pick up on this work again. They were not there. We did not have beggars. I spoke most of the information I have, apart from speaking with friends and things, are from students, who usually are considered among the poorer, right? But it's more their reflection. And there was not a problem of, they never spoke of not having enough. So,
I guess going forward, something to think about if we're trying to disentangle the moralities of money and who uses money,
mm-hmm.
is how are those uses of money, people who are marginalized,
mm-hmm.
where do they fit in this moral schematic?
Thank you for that. I certainly bring it with me. Yeah.
Johannes Lenhart has been writing
about,
he's a good friend, has been writing about homeless people and their money use, and drug use and money use. And he, if you look at some of his papers, they will get a connection to a wider group of people working on these issues.
Actually, the thing I was going to mention, he wrote something, Andreas is next, but he also wrote some blog post recently that was very interesting about working as a private tutor and the discomfort of this very wealthy family of paying him in cash and preferring payments to be electronic all the time, and sort of with the sort of anonymity and lack of kind of interpersonal relations that entails. And part of that, he said, is that you know this dirty stuff of cash is precisely, is a leveler, at least insofar as it passes through everybody's hands. It has to be at some minimal level understood as a sort of shared collective thing, in a way that a credit card is the ultimate individual kind of private thing. So there seems to be something going on here, which is about means of payment.
Mm.
When you're asking, you're trying to think about a future in which there is no cash at all, even while you sort of see that there will always, the bank certainly seems to think there will always be some. So whilst there is more than one possible means of payment, there are questions about the social meanings of different means of payment.
That is what I'm after, in that sense. I first thought I was going, and compare it to the digital, but don't have material for that. But also this thing of as your colleague there, or friend, speaks about, is in Sweden is very much also concerned about not black labor. It has to be when you tutor someone, or if you, do whatever.
Black market
money, or black work, so to say, right? Because any cash in hand payment, that is more or less, it's a substitute, a metaphor for avoiding paying cash on it. Bad.
Right.
So it's not immoral.
But those are the sort of the social meanings that get acquired.
Yeah.
Because not every cash.
No, but then it also captures
this
connection to the state immediately, right?
I mean, Russia is a fantastic example of this. I've been doing work with expatriates who are accustomed to these kinds of electronic money work. And then they come to Russia where everything is cash. There is nothing but cash. And there's this horrible discombobulation when suddenly you're used to paying with electronic cards all the time. And now you've got this 5,000 ruble note in your wallet and you can't spend it anywhere because no one has the cash to make a change for it, but it's all you've got, and you're this American who doesn't speak a word of Russian, and you've got this big bill, and you can't do anything with it. So there is a lot going on there, not just when we have a current changing understanding of money within our own familiar cultures, mm-hmm. but when two cultures of money just come together and meet mm-hmm. in this incompatible zone.
I think, yeah, it's that proliferating means of payment and mm-hmm. that at the same time. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Andreas?
Yeah, what struck me was this language of securitization somehow. I don't know, I thought in your paper there was this tied to some values, like the island population will want to be independent, and suddenly it becomes more easier or pervasive to use it somehow, because here it's this language of hygiene, it's better to have it digital because it's filthy and all. But the outcome is, and I tried when I read the paper to figure it out what the difference is, and I think it's that you cannot store this money without the system. Mm-hmm. So you cannot even take it yeah. out from the bank and put it in a mattress yeah. or something. You have to be your, and that's a coercive fantasy, I think,
yeah.
that you are tied to the system.
Mm. And you are tied into it. I just told someone this morning, I was getting off on the bus, Leamington, father, and I asked, can you pay with cash? Because in Stockholm you can't. On the buses, I mean, they're completely cash free, and more stores also become that. No, sorry, we don't take cash.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something of really you're getting into the system, as you say, and I don't know if you call it securitization or what, but really you don't have a choice, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
you have to trust your bank, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
So you have to have a bank account.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it opens the issues of financial inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's something very interesting about sort of traceability of it as well.
Mm.
I suppose I was sort of
as a follow up of your remark, does it raise any questions about privacy? We are all in the middle of discussion about big data,
mm.
how the banks are selling our data
yeah.
to
mm-hmm.
companies, how we are like a consumer which is
mm.
on a plate.
Mm.
How you consume is like very traceable. So doesn't raise any questions about.
Very, very little. You can find small pockets of it. I haven't, you know, been following this very much, but
mm-hmm.
for example, because that's what I wonder about.
Mm-hmm.
This guy I quote in the beginning, he works, you know, with fairly advanced computer programming. Isn't he concerned?
Yeah.
Doesn't he see what is happening? You know, everything is traced, but very little, no. And that seems to, I mean, you know, looking into it, yeah. I think it's overruled by this idea of that you ought to pay your proper taxes, which is a very moral thing in Sweden. And that's a discourse, of course, because there exists a lot of this sort of like cash, but not on an official account and not on blogs and stuff like that. That's just something that is going on and you don't talk about that much. I just have to mention regarding Russia, and also when you spoke about almost alternative economies,
mm.
of Elena Ledeneva's work of Blatt in which is, you know, a way of exchanging in former
mm.
Russia, and to think about that of exchanges having value, and how there, when it was the Soviet Union, there was no use of coming with money because they didn't have any value. What could they use that for? It wasn't anything to buy for it anyway. You know, favors were much better, according to her book. So,
mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting.
Any other questions or comments?
Well, in Russia, actually, they had to move into the cash economy because the banking sector collapsed, and people who had put their money in the banks lost it all. So,
mm-hmm.
Who wants to go back to that?
Actually, there was recently a wonderful picture doing the rounds after the latest crash of the ruble, of a Russian Orthodox bishop casting the demons out of the central bank servers, because clearly this is a spiritual problem, the crash of the ruble. It's not an economic one, it's a spiritual one.
Well, that's what we say in a way, don't we? We say it's a values problem.
It's a values problem, it's a spiritual problem. It's, yeah, Russia and money.
I think something occurred to me towards the start of your paper where you talk about the kind of decreasing significance of the state as money becomes cashless. But clearly it's really just it's the tangible, visible reminders of the state's role rather than the state itself, because in fact, by kind of everything being run digitally kind of through through kind of commercial banks, then, you know, the state is absolutely more central, and the sort of semi-autonomy of kind of cash that could be hoarded or sort of alternative payments, it, insofar as either cash or a series of possible alternative payment systems become suspect and associated with not paying your taxes or with illegal activity or with foreigners who've kind of come in. If that's the case, then one is the state is actually more and more central, even as it becomes less like visible every time you kind of pay for coffee.
Yeah, and that's the sort of, thanks for pointing that out, because that's the sort of what I'm struggling a little bit with. What does this really mean, right? But again, need more data in order to analyse it properly.
Yeah, and I think thinking about the sort of multiple means of payment, what you know, Bitcoin, you know, relies on the sort of absolute kind of visibility and traceability and everybody being able to see all of the transactions. Now, that's not the case when you use your individual bank account in relation to the private bank, but it is nonetheless a system in which, you know, you are disciplined by the kind of sort of scrutinability of your transactions nonetheless all the time, because everything is stored as a record of every single thing you've purchased, and that it shares that in common with it. And I'd be super interested to know how those kind of moves to alternative currencies and payments may or may not thrive in a context where national currency doesn't circulate so much as cash anymore.
Alternative currencies, if you speak about it like bonus cards and things like that, you know, that's as traceable as anything. I guess you have the same system here. I mean, if you use a bonus card and then you get the monthly letter where it gives you 20% off on those things you buy most, and so on. But alternative currencies, they are, the tax agency has gone out and say that, forget about it. That's taxable even worse than money transactions.
Yeah.
So they sort of like look through that.
Yeah,
and there were many of those, and they might still be in existence, but you can't find them on the web anymore.
Yeah,
they're gone.
And they can't call themselves money, it's all currencies, for that reason.
It's a stray thought. When you were talking about cash being sort of dodgy, shady, the link between those two concepts, and it struck me that that's possibly true at the everyday level of money, because the movers and shakers of illegal finance don't deal in cash. They deal electronically, but they've been very clever in the way that they wrap it up. So things like CDOs, derivatives, etc., are complex instruments, and the beauty of the complexity is that you can then hide transactions. So you were talking about the traceability, but at a certain level in wholesale markets, you keep creating these instruments that really can't be traced. So there is a dichotomy in shady finance of what you can see and what you can't see, just as there is in legal finance. And I just think that's really interesting that that cash has this connotation, even though it doesn't really represent the bulk of the legal finance.
No, but you're right. I mean, that's also, as Kaitlyn Saloom has shown, you know, that becomes digits. It's rather game or play. And then, of course, behind it all, it can be more or less shady.
Nate? Thanks for your paper. I just had kind of two things, not questions, to pick up on. One, the shift to the digital. It's kind of quite common to talk about it in terms of the presence of a ledger, like that's what the shift is. And when you move to banking, that's the kind of most notable example. But one of the things that is kind of observable is it doesn't necessarily mean that, and that there are different types of ledgers as well. There's typical ledgers like a banking system. There's like a Bitcoin distributed ledger that kind of documents transactions in different types of ways. So pseudo-anonymous, but still completely trackable. But then there's also digital cash, which doesn't work on a ledger system as well. And there are like, so when you think about that transition to kind of cashlessness, there's actually digital cash that exists also, that was pioneered in things like early phone cards, where so you actually have something that doesn't, like if you buy like an iTunes card, that goes to a ledger, but some of the old phone cards, like the value was in the card, and not, so the actual transaction and all the exchange value doesn't happen somewhere else, it happens in the moment.
And
a lot of contemporary like phone cards, like the early GSM, I think, this is modeled on the same technology. So when you speak with someone, there's a kind of a ticking over that's happening on the phone that's kind of calculating value that can work in this way of digital cash that gets picked up in like mobile money transfers and things in the developing area. These are like early technologies that can be used in different ways. But that's one thing. The other thing, when you're talking about the example of your friend paying for a coffee, as a hypothetical example of things that you might think about what it means on an everyday level, and this is something that Liz, you picked up about kind of personalization, like your credit card is for you, but when you take that further, like you use a phone that has, say, like your Google e-wallet or your Apple wallet that has built-in recommendation systems where maybe you get a discount at Starbucks. So you've kind of got the history of loyalty cards being built in to an entire package, and then you have personalized price based on those. So you get a kind of a layer on, you know, like the traditional economy, where you've got like radical personalization, which means that something like a price, as historically understood, kind of dissolves, and you have really specific types of price. That's something that I think is starting to happen, but it's interesting to think about it in terms of that, like, what does it mean when you buy a coffee? As a way to ground it again, as so you can map those changes by just thinking about, like, that one practice.
And price discrimination is kind of already sort of real in some context, and it's a massive political issue.
That was the whole point of Zimmel's unearned increment of wealth, right, is that, and John Ruskin, and the idea of unequal pricing, although not benefit to those who are already spending a lot, but as a benefit for those who cannot spend it a great deal.
I'm also starting to sort of imagine links to Trina's paper, where you might be kind of offered different prices to the person next door for your electricity based on what's known about your previous consumption compared to what's known about theirs, and nobody would know.
Or because you don't have a cat.